daily service led by the Reverend Peter Whittaker. Here on Radio 4 FM, Julian Barrett continues this week's Book of the Week, A Broken Hallelujah by Leo Liebowitz. It's 1960 and Leonard Cohen leaves London for love and inspiration on an idyllic Greek island. Extracts from his personal papers are read by Colin Stinton.
It was the winter of 1960, and Leonard Cohen, the author of two collections of poetry, several short stories and one rejected novel, decided to leave Montreal and travel, to recharge his creative drive. London was an obvious choice for a young man raised by Anglophiles who wore British tweeds and looked to the motherland as the source of all that was proper. It was also a place where a young poet could try to connect with the ghosts of Byron and Shelley and Blake. He lived with friends, bought an Olivetti typewriter, and worked for hours each day on his poetry. One day, while strolling around London's East End, he spotted a branch of the Bank of Greece. The weather was London at its dreariest, but inside the bank stood a tanned man, wearing shades. Cohen could not resist his siren song.
"It was the most eloquent protest against the landscape that I've seen."
"In Greece," the tanned man said, "it was always springtime." The next day, Cohen was Athens-bound. The enchanting island of Hydra became his home and his hideaway. Approached by boat, it juts out of the sea like a pyramid, its houses tumbling into the blue bay. He bought a white house on the top of a cliff, cobbling together royalties, literary prize money, and a small family inheritance, and spent his time drinking at Katsikas's taverna, or sitting on top of the whitewashed well, strumming on his guitar.
"You'd sing too, if you found yourself in a place like this. You wouldn't worry about whether you were as good as Ray Charles or Edith Piaf. You'd sing. You'd sing."
2 months after his arrival, Cohen began an affair with Marianne Ihlen, the 25-year-old former girlfriend of the Norwegian writer Axel Jensen. Before long, she moved into his sparsely furnished home, although she was afraid that her child would disturb Leonard's work. But each morning, Cohen would call out to the toddler, also named Axel, who would rush in and lie on the floor beside him and draw silently while Cohen wrote. This peaceful routine was dotted with daily strolls down to the beach, lovemaking with Marianne, dinners with friends, and the other discreet pleasures of living on an island where the power was often down for all but 2 hours a day, and you had to bribe the garbage man to pick up your trash.
Remember when the scenery started fading, I held you till you learned to walk on air.
But if his days on Hydra were tranquil, Cohen's writing was anything but. His poems were no longer the careful juxtaposition of the profane and the sublime. He no longer cared for balance. He was 30 years old, and he felt it was time to drop the act and dive deeper into his art. It was time to engage in a
process of self-recovery and self-discovery.
This meant that style and subject matter alike had to be bludgeoned. What still lived after the blows would be the real Leonard Cohen. Often this process made Cohen's new poems read more like lists, purely informative and bereft of artifice. In the poem All There Is to Know About Adolf Eichmann, for example, Cohen provides a mundane list of attributes, the sort usually associated with a passport or a driver's license.
"Eyes, medium. Hair, medium."
And so on, before concluding with acerbic observations, casually delivered.
"What did you expect? Talons? Oversize incisors, green saliva, madness."
Decades later, critics labelled Cohen's work from this period as postmodern. But unlike his postmodern contemporaries, Cohen was never particularly interested in form as such. Increasingly, and tellingly, for a poet about to become a singer and a songwriter, Cohen's way of speaking in verse hardened into rhyming couplets.
History is a needle for putting men to sleep, anointed with the poison of all they want to keep.
It was the same neat trick he'd learned on the stages of clubs and auditoriums in Montreal, disguising painful truths as aperçus. But as his explorations got deeper and darker, his lines grew more stunning and less personal. But Cohen wanted to do more than write harsh poems. He wanted to see the broken world for himself. In March 1961, he travelled to Havana. Just before leaving, he wrote a friend back home that he was
wild for all kinds of violence.
He was only half joking. Castro had been in power for 2 years, and Cuba seemed as close as Cohen would ever come to his great hero Lorca's bloody and idealistic Spain. Lorca had lived in Cuba for 2 months in 1930, wrote about it enthusiastically, and left enough of an impression to have Havana's grandest theatre named after him. But Lorca's Cuba was long gone, and the island Cohen found was a faded rock. All the glamorous, raucous pleasures of Fulgencio Batista's regime, the casinos, the brothels, had been outlawed. Instead of Hemingway's, the bars were now occupied by mirthless Russian engineers, sent by Moscow to supervise its Caribbean satellite. Cohen didn't mind too much. He wore khaki shorts and grew a beard, and ambling around town soon discovered that the prostitutes and the gamblers were not really gone. They were too vital to the island's economy, so they were merely made less conspicuous and were all too happy to embrace him. Cohen referred to himself in a later poem as
the only tourist in Havana.
One night, a man in a dark suit knocked on Cohen's hotel room door. He identified himself as a Canadian official and asked Cohen to accompany him to the Canadian embassy at once. "Your mother," the diplomat said disdainfully, "is very worried about you." Soon Cohen learned that 3 B-26 bombers, painted to look like Cuban planes, had taken off earlier that evening from Nicaragua. Supplied by the CIA and piloted by anti-Castro Cuban exiles, the bombers destroyed several of the regime's grounded aircraft near Havana and Santiago. An American invasion seemed imminent, and Mrs. Cohen anxiously called her cousin, a Canadian senator, and asked him to track down her wayward son. At first, Cohen laughed the whole thing off. But 2 days later, Operation Falcon was launched, and nearly 1,500 men landed at the Bay of Pigs. Cuba was under attack, and Cohen, a bearded foreigner, was eminently suspicious. He was walking on the beach at Playa de Varadero when 12 soldiers with machine guns encircled him. They thought he was one of the invaders. As they walked him to the police station, he repeated in Spanish the most comforting sentence he could think of to convince the soldiers he wasn't Kennedy's spy.
Amistad del pueblo, amistad del pueblo, friendship of the people.
That did little to convince the soldiers, but before too long, Cohen, stringing together a few sentences in Spanish, turned on his effortless charm. The soldiers poured him a glass of rum, gave him a shell necklace and a piece of string with 2 bullets to wear as an amulet, hugged him tight, and let him go. With the invasion's catastrophic end, just days later, came many arrests, some of them targeting tourists. Cohen decided to leave. Every day, throngs swamped the shelled airport in search of a visa. Cohen joined them and eventually managed to secure a ticket out of Havana. But when he lined up to board the plane, the clerk called the person before him and the person after him, leaving Cohen stranded. Cohen saw that his name had been crossed off the passenger list. He was taken aside by an officer and told he couldn't leave. The reason given was a photograph found in his bag featuring him, all khaki shorts and stubble, hugging the soldiers who had arrested him a few days earlier. It was just too suspicious. He was clearly a troublemaker, not a Canadian poet. He was placed in detention and guarded by a 14-year-old with a gun. when a scuffle elsewhere in the airport distracted the armed youth. Cohen got up, left the room, boarded the plane and told himself everything was going to be all right. A short while later, he landed in Miami. In Havana, he had seen power corrupt, and having seen it, he urgently wanted to write about it.
Power chops up frightened men. I saw it in Cuba.
To much of the rest of the world, however, he was a dilettante, hopping from his Greek island to Havana to play at revolution. After the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, he wrote a light-hearted letter to his sister, Esther, poking fun at much of the Cold War's hyperbole and paranoia. Soon, her husband wrote back, accusing Cohen of being a pseudo-intellectual, who wasn't morally serious enough to grasp that the conflict pitted good versus evil. Cohen, usually sanguine in his letters, replied harshly, and his reply ran to more than 7 pages.
The truth is, Victor, that war was declared a long time ago, is being fought today on both sides of the curtain, and its outcome is more important than the temporary and perhaps fictitious struggle between East and West. It is the war between those who conceive of existence as a dynamic rainbow, and those who conceive of it as a gray monotone, between those who are willing to acknowledge the endless possibilities, agonies, delights, mysteries, and destinies of the human predicament, and those who meet every human question with a rigid set of answers, some immutable inheritance from a father or a god or a revolution. It is the old war. Athens against Sparta, Socrates against Athens, Isaiah against the priests. The war that deeply involves our Western civilization, the one to which I am committed.
So, Cohen had identified his war. But how to fight it? His poems were one way, but increasingly they seemed unfit for the task. The more he understood what he wanted to say, all that prophetic stuff, the less enamored he was of poetry. He needed to find other means of expression. So he decided to sing. He traveled to New York, the world capital of the record industry, to take up a room at the Chelsea Hotel and reinvent himself as a writer of songs.
Oh, you are really such a pretty one. I see you've gone and changed your name again. And just when I climb this whole mountainside to wash my eyelids in the rain, oh, so long, Marianne. And we began to love and cry and laugh about it all.
Julian Barrett was reading A Broken Hallelujah by Leah Leibowitz, with Colin Stinton as the voice of Leonard Cohen. The producer was Pippa Vaughan, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 4. And you can download archive interviews with Leonard Cohen and many other musicians on the Radio 4 on music pages of the Radio 4 website. Later, Carl Jungers is looking at the cost of weddings. Should your big day cost you £15,000 on average? You can have your say on Carl Jungers. The number to call is 0370 0100 444. Coming up after the news, Woman's Hour looks at the role of women in the French Resistance. That's after this.
The peregrine falcon encapsulates the dilemmas that conservationists face when dealing with a rare or special being.
The new series of Shared Planet begins by looking at conservation.
We're on a public footpath. There's a great big cliff above us where you say they nest. You're not going to be able to stop people walking underneath the nest.
One estimate suggests that of the global trade in plants, which is worth about $9 billion, 6% of that trade is in plants taken from the wild and traded illegally.
To protect a rhino, you need serious, often paramilitary level protection.
Shared Planet on BBC Radio 4. This morning at 11 o'clock.